Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report, everybody. I am Johnny Roll. It is Thursday, and as always, gigantic show. Tons of news to get to. Two guests joining us on the show as well, so you're not going to want to miss any of it. And to sort of lure you into staying, here's what we're going to be talking about. In the beginning of the show, we do have an update on Donald Trump's legal troubles and the apparent fear that apparently is nestled deep inside of his heart about the campaign finance violations that his former lawyer has already gone down for. So we're going to have some brief analysis of that. Then we're going to have a guest on to talk about today's upcoming vote in the Senate on cutting off ties between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia when it comes to their war on Yemen. Absolutely massive vote coming up. We're going to do some analysis of that. And then this month, supposedly long-awaited peace talks between Saudi Arabia, Yemen, the different parties involved in that conflict. What can we actually hope to come out of that? We'll be talking about that as well. Another guest joining us a little bit later on. Apparently, Saudi Arabian lobbying money, which has been in the news quite a bit over the past month or two. One person inside the White House that has taken a massive amount of money from Saudi Arabia finally cuts ties with them. But why? That is going to be an interesting question we're going to try to answer a little bit later on in the show. In the middle, you're going to want to stay because we're going to do what I think a lot of people have been wanting. We're going to cover butterfly news here on the Damage Report. No, but really, we have two massive stories viewed through the lens of the butterfly populations that they are destroying. I know it sounds weird, but it's going to make a lot of sense once we get into it. And then a little bit later on to close out the show, Mika Brzezinski gets in trouble, I think, perfectly legitimate reason why. We'll be breaking that down and the response from a number of different parties a little bit later on. I do want to say two things we will not be talking about that are sort of breaking news today. There is the guilty plea of Maria Butina. She has pled guilty to being an unregistered foreign agent in the U.S. for Russia. Honestly, at this point, the stuff about that story that will be interesting or impactful, we don't know any of it yet. Obviously, we know the history. We've talked about the history, but the implications are not clear yet. So I'm going to wait a little bit until we actually know more about how important her activities in the U.S. actually were before diving any deeper into it. And secondly, the Robert Mueller investigation is apparently going to enter into a new phase and a new area geographically in 2019. That is Middle Eastern efforts to impact U.S. elections in terms of lobbying money and blank. But again, at this point, I don't know what that other stuff is going to be. We're going to have a little bit of that in the interview today. But where, you know, the special counsel's office comes in, honestly, we don't know enough to really say at this point. So we're going to have to wait and find out. So with that big show, let's jump into it. I have been very curious since Michael Cohen was sentenced to 3 years in prison to see what the president's response is going to be. Because as I said to you earlier this week, his argument that these are at best minor crimes committed by someone other than him that technically aren't crimes and that they're only getting in trouble because they're trying to get a lesser sentence for other stuff and it was just civil and they didn't know, all of those excuses sort of make a lot less sense once a person has been sent to prison for multiple years as a result of committing those crimes. Crimes, again, I'll remind you, that he alleges and the prosecutors in New York allege were directed by individual one, the president. So I believed that he would have to come up with some other defense as a result of that sentencing. But I apologize, I was wrong. He is simply doubling down. Here is what he tweeted out this morning. I never directed Michael Cohen to break the law. He was a lawyer and he is supposed to know the law. It is called advice of counsel, and a lawyer has great liability if a mistake is made. That is why they get paid. Despite that, many campaign finance lawyers have strongly stated that I did nothing wrong with respect to campaign finance laws, if they even apply, because this was not a campaign finance. Cohen was guilty on many charges unrelated to me, but he pled to two campaign charges which were not criminal, and of which he probably was not guilty even on a civil basis. Those charges were just agreed to by him in order to embarrass the president and get a much reduced prison sentence, which he did, including the fact that his family was temporarily let off the hook. As a lawyer, Michael has great liability to me. So, depending on which line of those tweets you read, Michael Cohen did something really bad or not bad at all, pled guilty for no reason because they weren't crimes, or he has great liability. It's really not clear exactly what Donald Trump wants to say because he kind of has to pursue two missions at the exact same time. because he's implicated in the same crimes as Michael Cohen, he has to state that Michael Cohen didn't do anything wrong, because if he did, and he went down, and Trump did the same crimes, then theoretically Trump could go down. But at the same time, he wants to demonize Michael Cohen. He doesn't want anyone to trust him. He doesn't want anything that Michael Cohen talked to the special counsel's office about to be considered serious or important or credible. And so he has to state that Michael Cohen is not guilty of anything, while at the same time trying to shred Michael Cohen's reputation. That is a difficult mission, especially when you have the communication skills of a 3-year-old. So I don't envy Donald Trump the task that was set before him in that. But it is incredibly complex that he pled guilty to things which weren't criminal. They've been saying that now for months. It's never made sense to me. Why are they pleading guilty to things that are not criminal? And what is the sentencing guidelines for things that aren't crimes? Apparently, he got several years, which is odd, because you would think that if something was not a crime, there would be no criminal penalties for it. So very confusing all around, not exactly sure what he's trying to say there. At the end, when he says that Michael has great liability to me, I don't know if that's a diversion. Is it a red herring? Or does it mean that Donald Trump is going to be suing Michael Cohen in the near future? I'm honestly not sure. The line that his family was let off the hook, I mean, his daughter was in the room. Did she commit a crime? Did she pay off a mistress? I've never heard anything about that. So very confusing. But when Donald Trump writes 3 full paragraph long tweets in a tweet storm in the morning, that implies to me that he's doing one and or 2 things. He is either watching a lot of Fox News and is very concerned about the conversation they're having about this case, which I find to be an unlikely explanation at this point, because Fox News apparently doesn't want to talk about the Michael Cohen thing at all because of the implication that Donald Trump was implicated in those sentencing memos last week. It seems more likely this is just a thing that is on his mind. And Donald Trump, a guy that loves to exude this aura of confidence, clearly is worried about the implications here. Again, we have moved far beyond any hypothetical, what does this potentially mean for the president and the investigation and his team? Maybe they'll find something, maybe they'll discover something, maybe someone will flip and then they'll say something. No, Michael Cohen's going to prison. And he's going to prison for crimes that the federal prosecutors say Donald Trump helped him to commit. Now, there's a lot more that we could get into. Obviously, there's there was a 2008 case that was sort of similar with John Edwards, where he actually faced criminal penalties for exactly the same sort of paying off mistresses. That's obviously not good for Donald Trump. And there's a great deal of hypocrisy there, because many of the same Trump defenders who are now saying Donald Trump can't be held liable for anything were at the time writing articles about how John Edwards was definitely guilty. So we might return to that at some point. But I want to talk about one of the developments yesterday in the meantime. Obviously, Michael Cohen and his cooperation with the special counsel, it's bad news for Donald Trump when it comes to this case. But there's also the National Enquirer. And there was a big development there yesterday where they admitted that they had committed crimes. They're not apparently going to be charged for it, because they are now, as well as Michael Cohen is, cooperating with the special counsel's office. So both Cohen and AMI, that is the parent company that owns the National Enquirer as well as other things, have stated under penalty of perjury that the payments they made to these women were meant to influence the election. AMI told the government that in August 2015, a year before the McDougal payment, that was the Playboy payment, its chief executive, David Pecker, had met with Cohen and an unnamed campaign official, it'd be interesting to find out who that is, to offer to help cover up any negative stories that might emerge. It then did so, paying McDougal $150,000, quote, to suppress the model's story so as to prevent it from influencing the election, as the agreement with the government reads. That by itself is illegal, but AMI won't be charged under its agreement with the government. Now, for them to not go down for this, I would imagine that they know quite a bit, that they can say quite a bit about other people's involvement. Obviously not about Michael Cohen's. They've already got Michael Cohen. Now, it might be that they have something on this unnamed campaign official. You know, and that could be virtually anyone at this point. That could be Don Jr., it could be Paul Manafort, it could be Lewandowski, it could be a bunch of different people, maybe a name that we're not familiar with. Or it could be that they know something about Donald Trump. Now, to that illegal action and why AMI finds itself in a position where they do need to cooperate, they had expected at the time to be reimbursed by Trump, but ended up canceling that plan once its lawyers explained how that reimbursement would undermine any argument about the legality of its payment. And again, that gets to the question of, is this a campaign finance violation? Now, we already know that they believe it is, because Cohen went down for it. But If it was not being done to influence the election, then theoretically it is legal. But there's a lot of reasons here to believe that this was not just about hushing up a story. This was not just about protecting Donald Trump's reputation. First of all, the fact that these affairs, which happened years before the payments, were only being paid right in advance of the election. Clearly that makes it seem as if there was a deceitful nature to it. The fact that they lied repeatedly over the course of more than a year about these payments, that certainly doesn't look good. The fact that they routed the money through shell companies, that's gonna hurt their argument a little bit too. And we already have at least one audio recording of them talking about what form the payment should come in so as to make it harder to track. All of that really hurting their ability to say that this was just about an affair being covered up. But much more importantly, and this is something to look forward to in the near future, not only is AMI CEO David Pecker known to be longtime friends with Trump, it was reported over the summer that he kept a safe in his office full of documents with information that could be damaging to the president. These documents were reportedly acquired via a catch and kill practice of paying for the rights to stories and then not publishing them, keeping the information secret. That same practice is what AMI is said to have done with McDougal the story. So maybe it's McDougal, maybe it's another woman, maybe there are many women, or maybe it's about things other than affairs. But apparently they were going around for longer than a year buying up these stories and hiding them. It might be that the things they're hiding are merely embarrassing and not actually evidence of criminal acts. Or it could be that we're gonna find more.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
About various aspects of this ongoing investigation coming out of that safe in AMI's office. We'll have to wait to find out. That said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, this big vote happening a little bit later on today, the future of U.S. involvement in the Saudi war on Yemen. Which way is it going to go? We'll debate that after this. Just hours from now, finally, the Senate is going to hold a vote on the future of the U.S. involvement in the Saudi war on Yemen. We don't know exactly how it's going to go, but there are some good signs. Will it turn out the way we want? Let's talk about it now. We're very happy to invite to the show Hassan Al-Tayeb, co-director of Just Foreign Policy. Hassan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Great to have you here. So I'm excited to talk about both this vote and sort of the context of the ongoing conflict in Yemen around it. But first off, yesterday, when the Senate voted 60-39 to open debate on this, that fairly large margin, does that give you hope that this vote is going to go the right way later on today?
It does give me hope, and I don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure we have the votes to pass this. It would be totally historic.
Yeah, it certainly would, and it would be great news, honestly, considering what happened in the House yesterday, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. But I did want to say, in advance of the Senate vote, early on today, the White House was putting out from various officials these statements that the senators should be extremely worried about harming our relationship with Saudi Arabia, that this could send the wrong signal. How worried do you think we should be about that?
I don't think we should be worried. I think it's time to stop giving Saudi Arabia a blank check to commit war crimes in Yemen and to commit war crimes in our name, and we have to stop giving them the moral cover. Also, I want to mention that this forward momentum, and all this momentum we've had on the War Powers Resolution has really opened up peace talks in Sweden between the Hadi government and the Houthi rebels. Mm-hmm. Just today, they announced that there's going to be a truce in a ceasefire in Hodeida, which is the lifeline of Yemen. It's where most of the humanitarian assistance is going to get into the country. So this is amazing. And I think in addition, there's about 15,000 prisoners that are going to be exchanged. So
Wow. We,
you know, there is tremendous momentum. And I think it's all been really supported by the pressure that we've been putting on the administration and Congress. And the forward momentum with the War Powers Resolution.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because obviously, you know, the world is going to be watching to see how much can actually come out of those talks. You know, hopes are certainly high. And I'm curious, we talked to the last time you were on the show, we talked about how the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and the international outrage about that, how that might be influencing views of this conflict. But if these talks are going on right now, if the Senate votes today to cut off U.S. support for it, how do you think that might influence the ongoing peace talks?
I just think it gives more leverage to the peace talks, because the Hadi government will know that we are not going to indefinitely support Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. And that gives Martin Griffith and the UN Special Envoy a lot of leverage when he's, you know, discussing the situation in Sweden. So it can only help.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. So you mentioned leverage, and I've found it a bit odd that the messaging coming out of the White House about Saudi Arabia in response to questions of whether we should do something about, you know, them having murdered Khashoggi and then this, it sounds like, so from Donald Trump's point of view, they want to buy all of these weapons from us. Obviously, they need us to maintain and continue to supply their military equipment and things like that. He talks about it only from the point of view of what could be lost if we don't have those sales. But it sounds to me like even if we cut off support for the Yemen war, even if we have some sanctions over the killing, it sounds like we have far more leverage over Saudi Arabia than they have over us. Is that your perception? And do you think that it's just a sort of a willingness unnecessarily by the U.S. to not leverage that?
I think you're absolutely right. We are definitely the senior partner, and Saudi Arabia is definitely the junior partner. I heard Bruce Rydell, to quote him, he's a CIA analyst, he's worked with several presidential administrations. He said we could actually ground the entire Saudi Arabian military within a few days just by cutting off the sale of spare parts for, you know, refueling, spare parts to their military, as far as, you know, tanks or, you know, air for their tires, and just we have a lot of leverage here, is what I'm trying to say.
Exactly. And, you know, especially their air force, like we have sold them those things. But in terms of training for it, and certainly for, as you point out, continuing the maintenance of it, they do need our help. We had some reporting earlier today, Ken Klippenstein from TYT, he got access to a document showing that sort of maintenance contract between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is going to be extended to 2025, implying that they don't believe that even by that point they can have developed either the technical expertise or the parts necessary to maintain those weapons by themselves. Again, that's massive leverage for us, but we keep acting as if we desperately need their approval and support and certainly their money, which seems odd. But I do want to ask you about yesterday's vote. So that was the one that did not go quite as well. In a farm bill that had nothing to do with Yemen, there was this provision added in by the Republicans to cut off any expected or necessary debate under the War Powers Act. And it narrowly passed, thanks in large part or possibly entirely because of the five Democrats that actually supported it. How did you respond to that vote?
Well, that was, I think, a sham. And the fact that they are basically gutting the War Powers Resolution and preventing any further action by the House of Representatives on the War Powers Resolution in regards to Yemen for the rest of the 115th Congress is an abdication of congressional war authority. So under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war. And this war has never been voted on by the House of Representatives in a clean up or down vote. And it's really, they're abdicating their responsibility and their job to, as members of Congress.
Yeah. And it's odd because if we know anything about politicians, it's that they continually want more power. In the rare instance where they willingly give up that power, it makes you really wonder why they would be willing to do that. Especially when, in the case of this continued support for the war on Yemen, there's no domestic constituency for that whatsoever. So what is actually leading them to be willing to say, oh, we don't want to go on the record. We don't want to vote. We give all that power to the president. It certainly seemed to me like that's an odd stance from these representatives.
Absolutely. So Congress likes to basically let that power go and say, oh, the administration is to blame. And then when things go bad, they can point their finger. But if they had to actually make a clean vote, then they would be responsible for what happens. And they would, you know, they don't want to be responsible for 16 million people living on the brink of famine right now.
Exactly. The problem for them is that we are going to remember those names and do our best to hold them responsible.
I encourage your viewers to use the hashtag #TheFamineFive. Those are the five Democrats that basically voted against the rule to strike this down.
Yeah. I agree with that as well. Hassan, thank you so much for joining us once again. And we'll continue to watch for as these peace talks develop. Maybe we can talk once again once we have more progress there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. But when we come back, as alluded to earlier in the show, a tale of two butterflies, how different butterfly populations intersect with our policies on climate change and the border wall after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. So much to get to. Let's get into our big block, much requested butterfly news on the Damage Report. When we talk about climate change, we often talk about big things, big changes in the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, gigantic hurricanes and forest fires and things like that. But let's for once talk about something very small, and that is the monarch butterfly. Now, if you are in California, as we are here, you might have noticed something a little bit weird about the monarch butterflies, and that is that there aren't any. And it's odd because at one point there was a lot, actually. In the 1980s, between 10 million and 4.5 million monarchs spent their winter in California every single year. The last count, conducted annually by volunteers each November, showed that in 2018, there may be as few as 30,000 across the state, a number that's 87% lower than just the year before. And overall, we've lost 97% of the monarch butterflies in just a couple of decades. And it's the sort of thing that if you were not some sort of butterfly aficionado, you might not have noticed, because it's hard for humans to notice things when they're not there. But that is absolutely massive, a huge change over the course of less than one lifetime, just a couple of decades. We've lost almost every single one of this species that we just took for granted for a long time. And that is not some accident. There's a couple of different ways that that people in America have caused that. And let's break them down. But first, a volunteer guide who works in the areas where they count these butterflies, Anthony Gutierrez, says, "It's a sad reality of climate change. For every little thing that changes, there's not just one consequence. It's a whole chain reaction." And that is the thing about biology, is that you can't, it's like when making manipulations to human genes, you can't get one little change. A lot of little things change as well, and sometimes cascade into massive things. But here's the situation with the butterflies. For years, Western monarchs have faced habitat loss in both the places they breed and where they spend their winters, increased use of pesticides, and as well, deadly stressors like severe weather and drought. And that is a problem in a lot of different places in America, but especially in California, where we've had years and years of drought, ever worsening. It's one of the reasons that we have the forest fires that we do recently. And that is not just a problem for trees and the setting on fire of those trees. It's a problem for the animals that live out there in the wilderness. Okay, so if the drought kills something that the butterflies need to survive, then that might take a little bit for us to actually notice. And it might be a while before so many are dead that it turns up in these yearly reviews that they do. But it is absolutely massive. And here's the thing. Scientifically, when it comes to climate change, I've done a lot of reading, but I am far from a butterfly expert. I can't tell you at this point what long-term effect there will be for other animals or for nature if we lose all of our butterflies, but I have to imagine that it's probably not a good thing. And when you put it in the context of the other animals and insects that we've lost recently, I certainly think that there is reason to worry. This is something that we talked about earlier this year, but researchers in Germany found flying insect populations there had decreased by up to 82% over the last 3 decades. A collection of separate studies showed that the populations of most of the insect species included had been nearly cut in half. And you might recall, if you've been watching the show for a while, something like 6 weeks ago, we talked about a study of worldwide animal populations. So not just the insects, but the bigger animals as well. And in many parts of the world, their numbers had been cut down by 40, 50, 60, or even more percent. So what ends up happening? If we lose the butterflies, okay, is it just sad because we don't get to take pictures of them, or you know, you don't get to walk around in a dewy field and think, my, isn't nature beautiful? No, it probably has consequences. We certainly know with the bees that it does. We've lost almost all of our bees in America because of our widespread use of pesticides. That is going to make it difficult for other plants to pollinate and spread. It has an impact, obviously, on farming. All of these things add up. And at the end of the day, can we really say that the path that we're treading right now when it comes to our environment, when it comes to our approach to animals and plants, that it's sustainable, that this is not going to have a long-term effect, not on the little things like the butterflies, but on us as well? I can't tell you that. And when I see something like this, when I see a story that we've lost all these monarch butterflies, I think this is the exact sort of story that nobody is going to care about. It's going to seem so small, so petty, so specific. It's California. It's monarch butterflies, but it's not just that. It's the context that they live in, and that context is an environment that is becoming inhospitable to more and more species on a yearly basis. And so let's turn now to a related topic. There's a National Butterfly Center. It is located in Mission, Texas, and it apparently is quite a thing. They have more than 240 different species of butterflies, including the threatened monarch, which we've talked about on the show, obviously, and the imperiled Manfredda giant skipper. All of those call the sanctuary their home. And I don't know what an imperiled Manfredda giant skipper is, but it certainly sounds interesting. It sounds like it'd be delightful to go to this place and see it. And the reason they have this incredibly diverse range of butterflies is because they've worked at it for a long time. The National Butterfly Center's conservationists earned the title by deliberately populating the 100-acre facility with a range of plants that specific breeds of caterpillars feed on. And it's not easy to do this. That is why this particular conservation center in Mission, Texas, an area, it's one of the poorest areas in America, actually, has tourists coming from all over the continent because of the great work that they've put in. Unfortunately, that work and the center might not be here for much longer if the Trump administration has anything to say about it, because the border wall could end up destroying a vast percent or possibly the entirety of the center. Construction of the wall is expected to begin in February through the 100-acre habitat. And the government sent this center a letter telling them what they can expect when construction starts in just a couple of months. The officials at the center interpret the government's announcement letter to mean that the wall that's going to be going through this butterfly conservation center will be as high as 36 feet with gates at least 18 feet wide and 20 feet wide to accommodate vehicles. So a massive high wall, gigantic gates, roads running through it. What effect does this have on the delicate biological system that they have set up there? I don't know. I will leave it to them to explain it, but it is worrisome. The letter that they sent, the accompanying maps, outlined a 150-foot-wide enforcement zone south of the wall where all vegetation will be cleared. All of that vegetation that has been carefully cultivated and curated from around the world so that specific caterpillars will come and feed in it, so that specific butterflies will eventually go through the area, is going to be pulled out of the ground to make way for an enforcement zone so that nobody can get close to that wall. And the thing is, it possibly goes worse than that. The proposed route would put 70% of the habitat on the side of the wall facing Mexico. So it would technically still be U.S. land, but you wouldn't be able to just casually go over there if you want. And again, that's the majority of the entire center. And the center said that the government hasn't yet indicated whether that land would be accessible once the project is completed or what kind of damage the habitat might suffer during construction. And look, it is possible that the people constructing the wall, those who are planning this, are really thinking about the effect it'll have on the butterflies and conservation centers and things like that. That is possible. But it also seems unlikely. It seems like they're going to want to have sight lines from that wall. They're going to want to make sure that nobody can get close to it easily. And to do that, they're probably going to tear out all of that vegetation. And right now, I mean, you might want to go if you're in the Texas area and you want to see it, as a lot of tourists do. You might want to go now. The president of the North American Butterfly Association says on a good day, you can see a cloud of 200,000 butterflies. And they say that it's like something out of a movie, because when you're walking around, you have to keep your mouth closed so that you accidentally won't suck a butterfly in. That's how thick they are in the air, at least until now. And that's what we get, not only with our approach to the climate, as we talked about previously, but the way that we approach nature generally. Thankfully, environmentalists over the past few years have been raising a lot of concerns about the wall, not just for the reasons that we talk about most. The effect it has on immigration, the message that it sends to the rest of the world, the huge expense, you know, how difficult it'll be to construct, the waste of money that it represents, all of that. But also that in many places, whether in Mission or elsewhere, it is going to be cutting across the habitats of different animals. It's going to be making it so that they can't move from one area to another, either to chase food or naturally as the seasons change. All of this has been well known for a long, long time, long before this new push for the wall. But the wall is still likely to be built, especially if the Democrats capitulate and give them the $1.6 billion that Chuck Schumer, up to about a week ago, was considering giving them. And as a sort of added bonus, you not only lose the butterflies, but Mission Texas, which, as I said, is in one of the counties in Texas that is the poorest, that most needs the money, earns millions of dollars every year in tourism dollars for people going to this center. And that could be completely annihilated over the course of the next year as well. So if you live in Mission, you too could end up being hurt at the same time that the butterfly populations are being devastated. And so again, I apologize if this seems a bit esoteric, a bit specific, but these sorts of small level things, the throwaway stories that you see in one outlet and then it's gone, I mean, that shapes an area, that shapes a town theoretically. This is one of the most diverse habitats for butterflies anywhere in America, and it could soon be gone. And the butterflies themselves could soon be wiped out if we don't change our approach to things like pesticides, moving into the areas where they live and developing there, and of course emitting so much carbon that it literally is too hot for these animals to continue to live where they traditionally have. These sorts of extinctions do happen. I'm not pretending that the Earth has never seen it, but generally it doesn't happen on the time frame of a couple of decades, or in the case of this last story, a single year. That said, we are going to take our second break. When we come back, Saudi Arabia lobbying money. How has it affected U.S.-Saudi relations? And how has it gotten into the White House as well? After this. It sometimes seems like there's no one in the White House who is not functioning as a foreign agent for at least some government. But as of today, there's actually one less. This is Richard Holt, who had served as a lobbyist for the Saudi government, cutting ties with them. But why exactly? And what influence did he have up until yesterday? We're going to be joined now by an expert to talk about that, Sarah Kleiner for the Center for Public Integrity. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, John.
Very glad to have you here. So this is not someone that I had actually been familiar with. So if you could give us just a brief rundown, what function did he serve for Donald Trump, and what is his relationship with the Saudi government?
Sure. Richard Holt, I'll give you some context going back a number of years, but most recently he has been on a committee, a commission that advises the White House on fellowship appointees. And we're talking about high-profile people. Colin Powell is one, who have these fellowships in the White House and in governmental agencies. So he's on a commission that advises the White House. While filling that role, he also was hired by the Saudi Arabian government to represent them in the United States as a foreign lobbyist.
So, of course, he did have to register for that. So this is not one of the cases where he was an unregistered lobbyist and theoretically could face any sort of legal things. He was actually registered, and now he's apparently stepped down. Do we have any idea why that might be?
So I attempted multiple times to reach out to Richard Holt and did not hear back most recently. In late October, I reached out to him. And he wrote back and said he was reassessing his roles and didn't specify why. And I asked him if, and as we can talk about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a Washington Post columnist and critic of the Saudi Arabian government, I asked if that had anything to do with his decision, and he didn't answer that question. And then now he's not responding to requests for comment.
Well, that is certainly interesting. I mean, the past couple of months, there's been a lot of news where Saudi Arabia has been front and center, both the murder of Khashoggi, but also this new debate about whether the U.S. should continue to support the Saudi Arabian war effort in Yemen. I suppose it's possible that either of those could be the explanation, although I guess defending the Saudi interest in both of those cases is literally what he was being paid to do. So do you have any belief that we'll eventually figure it out, or does he seem like he's just going to go to his grave without revealing it?
Well, I think that I can tell you that we're going to keep on the story, and we're going to keep an eye on the filings, FARA filings, to see if he reinitiates any sort of relationship with the Saudi Arabian government. Because the wording in his most recent filing, which the Center for Public Integrity got a copy of, said that he was suspending his representation. So, you know, we're going to keep an eye on filings and see if that relationship reignites at some point in the future. And, you know, we'll keep trying to find out exactly why he severed his ties. He is not alone. Other big name lobbying and public relations firms around Washington have also severed ties with the Saudi Arabian government. Mm-hmm. So he's not alone in that. And I did want to point out that Richard Holt is someone who has very, very deep ties here in D.C. For over three decades. He actually was instrumental in protecting savings and loans from regulators back in the 1980s when they were going through a financial crisis. And then fast forward to the Great Recession, Richard Holt was hired by Citigroup to provide, not as a lobbyist, but to provide sort of insight and feedback. And that was when financial institutions across the country were going under. Citigroup itself received $45 billion in government relief, in TARP funding. Back then. So this is someone who has been around for a long time and has had some controversial connections in the past.
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad that you brought up how well connected he is, because I want to get to before yesterday. So the time that he was serving both as one of these fellows, but also as a paid lobbyist. And let me just, this is a number that I believe is cited in your article and some of the others, but apparently last year, the group that he represents received close to $1 million from the Saudi government. So this is not some small thing. He's very well paid. But at the same time, he says that he never actually directly lobbied to Donald Trump for the Saudi government, which implies that one of two things is true. Either he's lying, or the Saudi government was really ripped off in their dealings with him, if they're paying that huge amount of money and maybe getting nothing out of it. Which do you think is the case?
You know, I'm not sure. I can't really answer that. I do know that he had declared on his forms that he attended meetings that may have benefited Saudi Arabia. But, you know, we have his, you know, his comments are that he never actually lobbied directly to Donald Trump. So, you know, we can't be certain, but we do know that he is part of like a major lobbying effort by Saudi Arabia. The government, the kingdom paid, it was $27 million in 2017 alone for firms around DC for representation, public relations, lobbying, and that sort of thing.
That is amazing. And I'm glad that there's been a lot of great reporting about this lobbying efforts, both by Saudi Arabia and other countries as well. So I'm curious, compared to other countries, how significant is the Saudi effort? I mean, if we were to look at Ecuador, is Ecuador spending millions of dollars in lobbying in DC? Is Madagascar spending millions of dollars? Like, does Saudi Arabia really stand out?
It stands out, and I can't speak to the specific countries, but it's definitely a massive effort, and it is growing each year. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has an interest in oil, policy related to oil and energy, and policy related to arms sales. They are one of the biggest purchasers of U.S. arms, weapons.
And so certainly economically, that they might be spending millions of dollars, but if theoretically it gives them access to billions of dollars of U.S. arms, as well as the intelligence and maintenance and logistics and all of that, it seems like from their point of view, it would probably be quite a deal that they're getting.
Right. They have a financial interest, and the United States has a financial interest in remaining allies with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Well, Sarah Kleiner, thank you so much for joining us and for your reporting for the Center for Public Integrity. We really appreciate you focusing on this important issue.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, one more story for you. Mika Brzezinski of Morning Joe under fire for one of the comments she made on yesterday's show. We'll be breaking that down after this. Only minutes remaining in the show, and I want to talk about, again, we had the tale of two butterflies. Now it's going to be the tale of two cable news hosts. So really fast, I just noticed this. Donald Trump, again, it's not just that people support him. It's that they support him while thinking that he is the brave one, the alpha one, the macho one. He doesn't back down, but he only does interviews on Fox News. Isn't that weird that they can believe both those things? So he was being interviewed by Harris Faulkner of Fox News, and she asked him some questions. Here are three of them. What do you love about being president? When you get up in the morning, what do you love? And you have such energy for this. Not every president would have worked 6 or 7 days out on the campaign trail. Now, in her defense, that's not actually a question. It is like a softball that's so soft that there's no question mark at the end of it. They all campaign, okay? They can all stand at a podium. That isn't difficult. What do you love about being president? I think protection from indictment is what he loves about being president, actually. Anyway, enough about Harris Faulkner. Let's move on to a story I wanted to get to yesterday. MSNBC host Mika Brzezinski is in some trouble for a thing that she said on yesterday's edition of her show. That's Morning Joe. And they were talking about Mike Pompeo, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and Donald Trump's relationship with them when she said this.
But why doesn't Mike Pompeo care right now? Are the pathetic deflections that we just heard when he appeared on Fox and Friends, is that a patriot speaking? Or a wannabe dictator's butt boy? I'm dead serious, I'm asking, are these the words of a patriot?
He's debased himself. He once again has undercut the conclusions of our intel community.
Wow, it's like you hear that and you just, ugh. So two things I noticed. She said, I'm dead serious about that. So it wasn't just a joke in case that comes up. Actually, three things. Two, he says he's debased himself. Really, she sort of debased herself by saying that, which we'll get into. And the third, you might have noticed that the audio cut out briefly. That's not in our editing. That happened on their show. And I believe that what happened is they tried to blank it out, but they missed it. I could be wrong, but it happened right after she said something that they definitely wish she had not said, or at least that no one had heard. So she called him a butt boy for the dictator. I wanted to know the specific definition of butt boy, so I went to Urban Dictionary, and because of that, I can't actually read the definition, but it's not positive. It's a derogatory term, obviously, that you hear used generally to disparage a person without any concern for all the different groups that you're lumping in that description. It's the sort of term that you don't generally hear on MSNBC because of the obvious homophobia laced throughout it. And yet she did just casually say it. And to the credit of either her audience or her critics, she was talked to about that and had to respond. And she tweeted this, totally agree with you, super bad choice of words. I should have said water boy, like for football teams or something like that. Apologize to Senator Durbin too. So sorry. So one of the things we have to do in this show is we have to evaluate apologies. And that's not the worst type of apology where she says, I'm sorry for my choice of words if you're so dumb that you have a problem with it. But she is sort of calling us dumb if she really thinks that, oh, she meant water boy or something like that. Benefit of the doubt, she doesn't know exactly what butt boy means. She's just heard it thrown around. She knows that it means that you're buddy buddy. She doesn't know about the sort of sexual component to it, maybe. But regardless, whether she knew or not, whether her audience knew or not, this is an opportunity to learn. And it is to learn that especially people who are straight, who have these high profile positions, they have an audience, you cannot be throwing casual homophobia into your political conversation and analysis. Not only is it completely needless and crass and anachronistic, but it is offensive to that community, whether they watch your show or not. their activities, regardless of what you think about them, should not be used to denigrate a person, especially in the case where she's using it, where it would be very easy to lodge a purely political critique of Mike Pompeo and Donald Trump. You can talk about the weird deference we give based on our military connections to Saudi Arabia. You can talk about Donald Trump's naivete in accepting whatever explanation of a behavior a dictator provides to him. You can do all of that without ever referencing anal sex. Now, look, she's not going to lose her position or anything, regardless of the fact that Donald Trump was tweeting that she should probably be permanently banned from TV for this. Donald Trump, someone who takes very seriously casual insults. But it is an opportunity to learn for Mika Brzezinski and for others as well. This weird thing where we say that people are doing homosexual things as a way of insulting them, that is something that people use. It's a thing that liberals and progressives use, and they shouldn't. Okay, you may not have a complete attachment to the idea of becoming woke in all aspects of your life or whatever, but this is one that definitely should be thrown in the waste bin of history. Now, that said, I want to thank you for watching the show, especially if you're watching on the member stream. Thank you for doing that. I know it's new, but people seem to really be taking to it, and I appreciate that. If you're not a member, you can become a member by going to tyt.com/John and clicking the button. Thank you for watching the show. Tomorrow, Brett will be on to close out the week. We'll see you then. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.